Welcome, movie lovers, back for another Anatomy of Movie here on Popcorn Talk. Today, it's Molly's Game, the true story of the 26-year-old behind the most exclusive high-stakes underground poker game in the world. Stay tuned as we talk about it.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, grab your cards. Grab your bets, grab your chips, and enjoy the game. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
We have Dimitri Panos returning for 2018.
Happy New Year, everybody. Happy New Year, movie fans. Great to be back.
And there you go.
And I'm happy to be back to talk about a really good movie.
Yes. Aaron Sorkin's director...
Directorial.
Yeah, but that was a word I knew I would butcher, so.
Almost like sartorial, except it's directorial.
Yes, his debut as a director, Aaron Sorkin, lots to talk about, both behind the camera, in front of the camera, and so forth. But a couple of things right off the bat. First off, welcome to you, fans. If you're joining us for the very first time, a very special welcome. If you're returning, a very special welcome to you as well. We assume that you've seen the movie, so this is your spoiler warning for the day. And thirdly, you can get our rundown in the description box. That way you can follow along, see our notes, and so forth. You know, some of the stuff we do pull out, some of the stuff is beneath the iceberg, as they say. But as we always do, we start with overall impressions. So, ladies first.
I really enjoy this one. I am a big fan of Aaron Sorkin, like Newsroom, and of course... I wasn't a part of the West Wing generation, but I do appreciate his writing. He's very fast-paced and very fast dialogue speaking, and I can attest to that. So, I love his music. I love his movies and just his writing style because I feel like I can keep up with it and actually understand what he's saying, which is great. I think he did a really great job in this movie, and watching it, I didn't realize he was directing it. This is his first directorial, so to speak, and it didn't seem like he missed a beat, honestly, because he's been doing it for so long. So I think he did a great job in that aspect. I love Jessica Chastain, and I will watch anything she's in. And I went in knowing it was going to be a lot of dialogue, a lot of things to keep up. But I went in and I left it. I was like, yeah, that was very, very solid.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very good film. Regarding Aaron Sorkin, he's done well as a writer, obviously, both TV and film. But he's also done well in surrounding himself with great talent. So when I watched this movie, there were hints of, like, David Fincher in here, which, like... No surprise, because he's gone to David Fincher for a few of his flicks that he's written, and his dialogue was really great. And I think for a directorial debut, it was actually pretty good. It was really well done. Maybe there were some pacing issues in the middle towards the end, but other than that, like, there was nothing about it that was overly flashy. It looked like a movie. It looked as if there were times where it wasn't directed. Like, and you like those where you don't point out, oh wow, that was directed. Jessica Chastain, I think, is an incredible performance here. And I learned something. Like, there's this whole... That whole underworld of poker, which was sort of brought up in the movie Rounders.
It's a great film.
Which is a really good movie. But this is more the elite, where Rounders is more in the bars and stuff. This was the higher end, outside of leaving that first club. Then it goes to the Four Seasons and then to Trump Plaza in New York and such. And it's, while as glamorous as it was, there was still the seediness of it all and the people who would be involved. So I found that to be very fascinating. It was great to see Kevin Costner. He still can act. He's really good. And Idris Elba, I thought, was perfect choice to play opposite of Jessica Chastain. I think casting for an Aaron Sorkin movie is very important. And if it's done wrong, they're going to fumble over the dialogue. You know, he has a very specific way in which he wants his dialogue to be spoken. And I think this movie was cast perfectly for that, because everybody was great with his dialogue, because he can be talky. Yeah, and the movie really looked good as well. Captured the time periods where we're at. There were times like you're actually feeling as if you were in a casino instead of, instead of a suite. So I thought that was great. Sound design with the clinkings of glasses and the smoke of it all. Like, I felt like I was there. So it was really well done.
Well, Marissa and I promised to invite you one day for our high-stakes poker games that we've been doing for a number of years now.
Oh, please. Please.
The Russian mob's not involved yet.
Yeah, I can... $2 buy-in?
Not quite. All right. Well, my thoughts on the movie. I overall enjoyed it. My one gripe with it was the subplot of the Scarlet Letter was slightly not as well executed, because I thought a lot actually hinged on that.
You mean The Crucible?
The Crucible. Yes.
The Crucible.
Yeah, wrong like movie.
Yeah. Wrong piece
this
of literature.
Not Hawthorne.
Yes. Yes. I think the reason I made that connection is because Emma Stone was in contention, or at least in Sorkin's mind, to play for the role, and she was in
Easy A,
which is about the Scarlet Letter.
Right.
And so there you go.
See, I get that connection.
Anyway.
6 degrees of Emma Stone.
But so, yes, The Crucible, I felt that wasn't as highly executed. Everything else I thought worked really well. You could say some of the dialogue, especially early on in terms of her narration, was a little bit over excessive. I've heard a couple of people say that, including our engineer Anthony, but I actually enjoyed it because it gave you her mindset and her outlook on the world and the mentality she was going into, you know, adulthood with. And I thought that worked really well. And I think the message ultimately of the movie, the Winston Churchill, which a quote that I want to definitely break down further with you guys, I thought was a perfect sort of hopeful ending to it all.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the overvoice, because I personally loved it. I thought that it worked so well in this movie. And, you know, that this is something that's usually reserved for film noir detective kind of movies and such. And I guess you can sort of call this a noir, because there is that underlying seediness of it all. It was used to such, for me anyways, I thought it was used to great effect. It never took away. I found that I was more engaged in the movie. It didn't bore me. And it actually drew me in. And the fact that it was, you know, perhaps it was just, I think it, in large part, Jessica Chastain's performance and the reading of it all in this movie. I did feel closer to the character and better understanding of what her thought process is, from not becoming an Olympic skier, why she ended up doing this. Like, it was all done through her voiceover, and I really liked it.
And it was meticulous, you know, especially early on with the math of, like, what the stakes of it all were, so you could see a natural tie into poker.
Yeah, and also Sorkin said himself that when he, for the conception, we'll definitely get into it, for the conception of just watching and why he had so much voiceover over the poker games while we're watching it, is that he himself has seen poker games, like the world tournament and whatnot, and he says it's actually very visually boring. It is a slower game to watch. So the only way that you can keep the audience engaged is if you make it faster, make it overcut, make a lot of voiceover. It actually keeps you engaged. And keeps the audience watching.
And the irony of that being said is that for a short time, ESPN and Texas Hold'em Poker was one of the highest rated shows on TV. People were watching it for the drama unfold, and it actually made the Penlight camera popular,
yeah,
because that's what they use, to see everybody else's hands. So it's funny to hear Aaron Sorkin say that it was boring, yet we're most of, if not a lot of America, that was the poker, the Texas Hold'em poker boon, in which online gambling was huge. Getting into the World Series of Poker, most anybody could, you know, I knew a person who, from online gambling, got a table at the World Series of Poker. So it's just really funny to say that he thought it was boring, but yet that's what drew people in learning that game of Texas Hold'em Poker.
Yeah, I think it's ironic. I think he should have said, from my perspective, it's boring. Just to say I get enthralled in poker And that's why I don't watch it, because I know I'll end up watching like 20 hours of it.
You could, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, it's interesting. A lot of sort of tidbits go into this. And he was never – not only was not interested in poker, he wasn't really interested in Molly Bloom or her story to begin with. And through all of this, you know, he met her, and then everything shifted because he saw the real her, the undertones that created the story. And he was like, wait. The story you're telling is not the story that's interesting.
Right.
So I appreciate that about him, that he's able to find something different in both the, I guess, the poker and also in her.
I think it's nice, too, because this is, I mean, I wasn't actually well aware of this story when it came out. And it wasn't that long ago in real time from the time we're talking about it now. But I think it's interesting because it was a big story that apparently I missed. So people have this already, you know, set prejudgment of Molly and what the book is and how people view her. And I like how Aaron himself even admitted that he had snap judgments of her. But when he had a sit-down meeting, she herself and just her personality and her own story intrigued him enough to be like, there's something here. Let's talk about it. Let's show something.
There was another factor that kept why Sorkin had his reservations about this as well. He knew some of the people that she was indeed writing about. He was friends. He's friends with a lot of these people. And, you know, he even told her, he goes, I know some of these people you've written about, and I've worked with some. He goes, others I'd like to work with. He goes, and if I'm going to go out and make a movie that gossips about them, that could, in a sense, ruin a friendship or two and maybe keep people from working for me. So he got over that, and I think they handled that in a really good way. And again, living out here in Southern California, particularly in the mid-2000s, you did hear about these, I don't want to call them underground poker places, but these exclusive poker matches were celebrities like Matt Damon. You heard about him playing Ben Affleck and such. Yep. These high-profile celebrities were playing these games, going to these high-end type of games. So I find it very, very fascinating. And I'm glad that he, you know, eventually turned around, but he didn't even look at himself as being a first choice either.
Well, we'll talk before we fully get there. One of the things, a big divergence from the book to the movie, is that in the movie – she had written the book before the trial. The book actually came out after the trial. So it's interesting in that sense. Part of the reason I bring that up is because when you speak about the actors and so forth playing poker, I like the way they handled it in the movie in terms of his solution, where it's I'm only going to name the people that have already been named in the first indictment or whatever you want to call it. And it wasn't her revealing it. It just came out.
It was out.
And the fact that that was a big part of who she was, I won't reveal it, but if you force me to, you know, if you take the hard drives or whatever else and that reveals it, then I can't stop you, but it wasn't me.
Right.
And I really like that, of just about her character and personality alone. She got so deep within this poker game, but at the end of the day, she still wanted to remain her integrity, and that's actually a very honorable thing.
Yeah, and it's a great scene in the movie when she talks about, that's what I have. I have my name. The whole thing, I like too, and that's the other part of Sorkin, where actually after the hours and hours of talking with Bloom, he says, these are the best parts of the story, because apparently the book ends with her arrest from the FBI, which the movie goes beyond that. And I like the way that Sorkin approached this, because we didn't just get a rehashing of a book. We got beyond that. And to me, too, that ended up being a very interesting story, too. Did anybody research? I should have Googled it, but I don't know who the actors were.
Actually, I did find out who Player X was. So Player X, in the most part, is Tobey Maguire, the celebrity. But they also said they had an amalgamation of a lot of different high-named celebrities into Player X. So it's like a lot of different personalities from a lot of different actors. But one of the main ones is actually Tobey Maguire.
Yeah, and that was a Spider-Man era, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was when he was big in the early 2000s. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
That was his heyday for sure. Yeah, other people, you mentioned a couple, but Ben Affleck, friend of Matt Damon, you could see him, Leonardo DiCaprio, and so forth. And, I mean, you know, to me, like, what's interesting about it was it's a very cautionary tale, but for the most part, she actually wasn't – I really was fascinated by this idea that she wasn't breaking any laws if she didn't take a cut. And, right. You know, the point of the story really was she just flew too close to the sun for her own liking, and she didn't do the background checks as she normally would and so forth. And had she continued in that very cautious path, she'd still be successful. We just wouldn't, you know, really necessarily know about it.
Yeah, and the other fascinating thing is it really is a tale of two cities. You know, I mean, New York, when she moves to New York, it greatly differs from L.A. and the people that she had. Her clientele in L.A. was different than the clientele that she had in New York. Outside of just location, the people that she was dealing with, completely different, far, how should we say?
I mean, it's interesting because they have, like, in blunt terms and a gross over generalization, actors, in a sense, are narcissistic by nature.
Sure.
And again, I'm sorry, like, I'm painting, like, a very dark side of actors. But, you know, you have to be because you don't necessarily want fame, that some do, but just the mere fact of, like, oh, I want to play all these different parts and so forth, there's narcissism involved. Money is a huge component of that. It might not be – there might be a more artistic driving force, but it's a huge component of that, so that's at play. And in a sense, you could say the same thing for New York. So it is interesting, like, that the – you really have to get into the subtleties of it all, and I think that's where Sorkin does his best work, is because they, like, you know, in terms of symptoms, let's call them, they're quite similar. But the way they express those symptoms are completely different.
In L.A., you had the posh, you had the actors, right? Yeah. Where in New York, you had more of the bourgeois. you had the Wall Street people. And you're right. There is that sense of narcissism that sort of kind of transcends. It doesn't matter. It really was about power. It was about money, and mm-hmm. how much wealth they had to drop down on a table. There was this competitive nature, too, about this.
Yeah, and that was a vast difference between the L.A. players to the New York, because L.A. Absolutely. Players, it seemed like people of convenience, people who – and they had a lot of Las Vegas players, because Las Vegas isn't that far from L.A. So you had the people who just liked playing. Some are smart, some are not. But when you move over to L.A. When you move over to New York, you had the people who just have money. Right. You know, and that they're terrible players, but they have the money to blow it on. And also just the shifts of the personalities, too. I felt like the people in L.A. really wanted power compared to the people in New York just wanted money.
Right.
It's also – and Marissa, in a moment, I'll prep you. I want to talk about a woman in a boys' club, essentially, but I'll talk about it from the guy's perspective. And Dimitri, you're welcome to jump in, too. You know, it's one big boys club regardless of L.A. or New York. And there is that sense of competition. You know, I think guys sort of have that, especially if they're into poker, if they're into sports. You're going to have that side to you, and that's what drives you. And it's a sense of adventure. You know, when you have that sort of money, what can excite you? Well, the idea that at any moment I could just, you know, on the river card, get a bad hand, and all of a sudden I've lost $1 million, and it's like, ooh, all right, well, now I got to get it back. And you know, it's the same way people race horses or other stuff. Like, I've seen stupider bets be made just over stuff.
Yeah, there's that addiction aspect. But I like that because we did see that in both L.A. and New York. You saw the people who didn't know when to quit.
Right.
And, like, I did enjoy that. For Jessica, for your, you know, question, is, you know, to... Molly, for the movie, to have the one female amongst all the alpha men like, it, I definitely saw that human interaction and just, like, her mentality, because I love studying people. So I, and this is juxtaposed with all the scenes of Molly and her father. So you know that she has a male issue. There's male authority issue. Like, I always saw that coming, and I loved, and we'll get to it, but the therapy session with her father in the park on the bench, that was one of the best scenes.
It was. And my favorite line in that was red herring. That was a red herring. But I love that scene. You're right. It was brilliant.
It was great. And it explained everything that I was thinking. I was like, yeah, she did love controlling men. And I understand that from a woman's perspective, it is hard to, how do you survive amongst a room full of powerful guys who can easily, LA, like, completely screwed it over.
Because well, they of both these guys. Did.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But just, like, just learning from the LA group, just how quick that they turned her back on her. And she's like, okay, I got to do something to regain that control over all these guys again. And I definitely saw that power struggle.
And again, I think, too, where the movies show, too, in LA, for poker, it was the thing to do at that time. So these actors get involved. Hey, yeah, it's all poker. We're going to do this. There are only a few people who actually, you know, there was one person that she called a gambler. Then there was the Michael Cera's character who basically played it. Player X, who basically played it. He's direct quote, I love destroying people's lives. Because I don't like the game, really. I like destroying people's lives. Where when you go to New York, it wasn't the thing to do. It wasn't the flavor of the month to do or the pretentious thing. These people just had money, and it was their way of power. Of like, they could play these high-stake games. And then, you know, when the mob gets involved, things, you know, can go awry. But those two are men of power. So I love that. I love the high glamour of L.A. set against the backdrop of New York business glamour.
Yeah. It's just different. Chastain, in particular, she praises, and Marissa, if you want to pull the quote, because I think you did pull it. She praises Sorkin for being able to write a female of this nature, looking for the subtleties without, you know, being able to draw them out when none really existed in terms of a roadmap. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, you know, one of the sad parts is, as you said, Marissa, she's trying to figure out the rules and control men, and yet the sad part is, at the whim of all these men, they just change the rules and say, screw you.
Yeah, and for that quote, Jessica Chastain says about Aaron Sorkin, in all situations, Molly is trying to follow the rules laid out by men who change their mind depending on what their whims are. I think his incredible writer is able to touch that pulse while we're all still blind to it. And I think it's true, because this is a game that she had really no control over. She had to learn about it and had to understand it just in order to properly set it up.
Right.
And when the guys changed literally the tables on her, she's like, crap, how do I get the game back? There's a moment in the movie where she's like, and this is where I realized I lost the game.
Right.
Yeah, and it's very sad in that way. But that's why, to me, as depressing as this movie can get in some points of it, I really loved the ending quote. She just pulls out Churchill. Success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. It's a quote that I had not heard before, and it was just so uplifting at that moment. You're like, oh, okay.
Right.
And I appreciated that about her, that she's just going to, no matter what, she's going to keep on fighting.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing bookend to just the film alone.
Where, sure.
Like, the mentality of what's the worst thing that can happen to you in games, just in general. Oh, yeah, your body could physically be destroyed. But also, it's the mental game at the end when she actually gets up. She's like, I get knocked out, but I get back up again. So it's the mental and physical just of game playing games in the world.
Sure.
As a general rule.
Yeah, and just in her sense in that world, she wasn't, or she still is alive today, but she was at that point of her life an entrepreneur. You know, and she took whatever experience she had from being a waitress in that club, knew what it took to get people to sit down, a hostess, but she was bottle service, which I found very interesting. And she knew how to upsell very well. And by working, then when she gets hired by that creep who gives her the duties of the poker match, even even the creep was like impressed with what she was able to do to continually get these same people to come back to pour even more money into the game. And, you know, but it was all done with a sense of service. I'm just providing a service for them. And the more the money that comes in, I get some money from that as well. So it only benefits me to serve them well in a legal, fashionable way. She ain't taking a cut. And I found that to be very, very fascinating because that was a world that I only knew of it on TV or on ESPN and gambling, but never that world.
Well, it was also interesting both from an actress standpoint, but also from the character perspective that she had to dress the part. You know, in particular behind the scenes, Chastain writes, "Never did I have to, for a movie, care about my look this much." And with her, you know, that essentially was Molly's game, was playing this part, making sure she dressed the part. Because, you know, with the creep initially, he's like, "What the hell are you wearing?"
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that up because Susan
Change
Lyle,
clothes.
Who was the costume person on this, you know, she talked about that. Her first LA poker game, she's wearing a dress from JCPenney. Nothing against JCPenney. But ultimately, if you're going to up that game, you know, it was, you know, you had, and even the character herself liked dressing up. So basically, costume, you know, Lyle guided her through. Molly had 90 costumes throughout the course of this movie. And she was attuned to what the character would do and think about how she would dress it. And don't forget, too, there was hair. And when you notice all the different various phases, her rise and then her fall, her clothing and makeup change to bright, fashionable, wow, you look great, to you're looking a little worn there. So it was very, I found that. I noticed the costumes, but in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I definitely noticed the difference between what she could be able to afford at JCPenney to now she was getting paid. She can actually afford high-end fashion clothes. Yeah, she could go to wherever the heck she wanted. And I noticed her hair also changed because it was messy and disheveled the first time. And then at the end, when she's finally getting arrested in New York, it's darker, it's longer, it's more sleek, it's more prestige. She has a prestigious look of someone who, not to say royalty, but someone who actually looks like a businesswoman.
Mm-hmm. She was an entrepreneur. She looked the part. She looked fantastic. But again, I think that too is part of her service, the people that she hired, the women that she hired. You know, she knew there's more than the game of playing poker. There is the game of getting people, clientele, to come back and reaching a particular clientele. She wasn't playing in seedy bars.
No, it's all about the experience
perception
of it all.
Mm-hmm.
Shifting gears a little bit, this is, you can say this is editing, but it's also storytelling, you know, in terms of the writing. The idea of going back and forth between the lawyer and slash present day and then going back in time and until the two meet, and then we finished out the story. So I wanted, you know, pacing-wise or otherwise, how did that work for you guys to go back and forth and you're getting all this information at the right time?
I love that structure. I'm a big fan of nonlinear storytelling because it does eventually make sense at the end. You know, Nolan does a great job of nonlinear editing and storytelling. One of my favorite movies, Pay It Forward, is also in the same structure. It's like you get the little bit of what's happening in the beginning and then you go back to the beginning. Very smart. I love it. Not once was I actually confused because there was a lot of information in this movie. It's like it's verbal everywhere. It's dialogue everywhere. You could get easily lost within what's happening. But not once was I lost, in which I think it's a great job of just giving us all the information we needed to making sense of what's happening in our life. And like in how people were treating her and what she had to do at certain points in her life. I think it was very smart.
Yeah, I felt it was done very seamlessly. There are movies in which it's very obvious. Oh, we're keeping going back to flashbacks. And sometimes in those movies it becomes tedious. But I think, again, too, with voiceover that really helped bridge that gap together very well, because we knew what was going on. And being that it went beyond the book, Like, we're not just reading this, this story. We're continuing to go forward and then come back into the present. But it also didn't do it in such a flashbacky way. Like, there wasn't a time where, like, Jessica Chastain would go, oh, yeah, and then we're back here. That's, again, I use that word seamlessly because if you're not paying attention, you're just thinking of this story. It's not bothering you. And you're getting all the, like Marissa said, you're getting all the information you need. And it was done through dialogue. Like, the way movies can be done. Well, you have to listen. You have to pay attention.
And Soren does a great job of setting up a joke. Like, the whole Crucible was a long film.
Sure.
The running theme that just set up for a quick moment with Idris Elba's, like, now is the time you read the Crucible. That was it. That's the only reaction. But, like, my whole audience, when I watched it, had a big reaction to it. That was set up from the beginning, and it got a payoff in the end.
She goes, yeah, it was great.
Yeah. And even the Olympic scene at the beginning, like, well, what's the worst thing that can happen to you? That was a 4 to 5 minute just rant of what could happen. Just to have her one line at the end, like, fuck you.
Yeah. So, for the person, like, who said he does coming in fourth the Olympics, that was a great line.
He does a great job of setting up, like, a long-winded story just to get a payoff in the end. That's Sorkin's style.
Well, it's the payoff, though.
It's the payoff.
Many people can't work the payoff. They can't stick the landing.
Yeah.
Well, what I appreciated about it was it was all those things working together. You know, generally, when you have a voiceover and the movie works without the voiceover, put it in the movie because the story doesn't hinge on the voiceover. It never should. And this movie in particular, I feel like, doesn't actually hinge on the voiceover. Which the elements to me that are at play is, number one, the voiceover generally is the book, right? So it's Idris Elba, the lawyer, reading from the book, and it's kind of that side of it. And secondly, so that's why it bridges the two together. And oftentimes, you know, we see him closing the book and we're back to the present day because, you know, he was just finishing up a chapter or something like that. Furthermore, I'd have to rewatch the movie for exact specifics, but the general idea being that if they're talking about, let's say, Player X, and, you know, they talk just enough to get us so curious that when we cut, we're on Player X and we're answering that question because that's what we want to know. And so it's right. Satisfying our curiosity. First off, it's generating enough curiosity, and then boom, getting right to it.
Mm-hmm. And how about the actual poker player, too? The guy in L.A. who loved – he was there to gamble. Like, he was the only poker – she even said, like, he was the only guy that was there to play poker because mm-hmm. he knew how to do it. Harlan Eustace. Like, that was a very interesting character. And they set up his rise and fall so wonderfully well. that character has, like, literally, I don't know how long he's in the movie for, total 15 minutes, yeah. Right? And that character has a full-on arc, you know? And it was described, and that's the other thing I appreciated about those overvoices, is that he was described when he's talking about stories about his wife. She's like, he meant every single word he said. He loved his wife. He couldn't wait to give his wife the birthday party of her lifetime. He was so happy about it while he played. And then we saw that twist of fate and how it all went downhill for him.
And also, it's like, it is an addiction. That's why a lot of people do go in debt because of, you know, poker.
Or blackjack.
Or just whatever, you know, billiards game that you choose. And I did like that when you're talking about arc, but that's Sorkin's writing style. He can get, and he writes so fast and so much in such a condensed time that a whole character can have an arc in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Crazy. Yeah. Very well done. And you saw that slow disintegration of his character, and you felt that because you knew he was an actually good player. But he just got caught in the game.
And again,
and he lost.
And I credit the actor, Bill Camp, as well. You know, he's a character actor. I credit all the actors because you need the right actor to pull that off. You have to believe in his jubilance when he wins and then the disparity that he hits. There was a time when he was outside on the balcony. Again, not having read the book, not knowing anything that's going on, I was thinking, he's going to jump. Like, mm-hmm. like he might jump right there. And then, so it was just, you know, that's how low I felt that that character had gotten, and I only know this guy for 15 minutes.
And his wife divorced him like the next day, so he lost
his
money
bottom.
and his wife. Yeah. I was like, ooh, double hitter.
I'm always fascinated. There's a lot of great books and articles and so forth about the psychology of gambling, but oftentimes they cite right before, it's not really the reveal that's the most climactic, it's right before the reveal, because at that point two possibilities exist, and you know, obviously you're rooting for a singular one of what you want, but your endorphins and so forth are just so high in that moment that that's the feeling you keep wanting to come back to.
Gambler's high.
Yeah. Let's talk about Idris Elba, because huge part, and we'd be remiss not to, in particular, that amazing monologue that he has towards the counter opposition, we'll call them.
Right.
I think it was great. I think this was definitely, it was great writing, great dialogue, great execution by Idris. I think this was also a moment, though, where I feel Aaron Sorkin needed someone to rein him in, because he just let him go. There wasn't actually a moment where Jaffe, Charlie Jaffe, that's his character, takes a pause to breathe, and he said everything he wanted to say, and then he keeps going for two more minutes. I was like, that's where you would have cut it. Like, all right, we got it, but he just kept going. And that's just how excessive the Aaron Sorkin can be in his writing. We know he's great at tirades. And it felt like this was also slightly contrived, so maybe Idris, if you wanted to give Idris an Academy Award nomination, it would be for The Saint Alone.
Yeah, I mean, I felt far different role than the gunslinger.
Yeah.
Very
and
much so.
What I appreciated about this character is he's an amalgamation of other people. Like, the character himself, Chris, doesn't exist. But you knew that she had a lawyer. But again, knowing that the book stops where she gets arrested, this is the part of the story that Aaron Sorkin chose to write about. And I found that the character doesn't break that cardinal rule of when you're making up a character. Her story is written, and in real life, how it ends, and she gets, I don't want to say she gets off, but it could have been much harsher. So we know that there was lawyers behind it. So this character doesn't really affect the real life outcome of that. And when you have Idris Elba and you bring in the daughter, I felt that the daughter was an extremely important part. His daughter, that character, Charlie's daughter, I felt was a very important part of this, because number one, there was the bonding between the daughter and Molly. And then there was Chris's, like, who's trying to care for his daughter. And there's that great line of dialogue. It's like, sometimes I think I'm far too hard on her. And he asked Molly, what do you think? Who's coming from an extremely stringent, hard father. Mm-hmm. And she goes, believe me when I tell you what I've seen in this world, you're not doing enough. You know, if you want her to grow up. And it was the daughter who urged him to take the case, because she actually had read the book. And the daughter realized that there's something there. Idris Elba's performance, I felt, was very good. I mean, he's a great presence. I didn't get the same sense with him going on too much. I actually loved that monologue. He's just a very solid actor. And again, he's someone who can act Aaron Sorkin's dialogue.
What I loved about this, actually, for just the character development alone, for the whole movie, for like three-fourths of the movie, you can say, for Molly, at this point, Molly's been playing this game all by herself. She really has had no one on her team. It's always been Team Molly. She's always looked out for herself. And then when he went on this monologue defending Molly, this, like, okay, this is the one person who can actually back her up. It's the one person who's actually rooting for Molly besides herself. And I think that was just a great character development, because, okay, she's not alone in this anymore.
Yeah, and it was a great arc.
Yeah.
Because he realizes that.
I think it's more than that, simply because I think she could get people on her side, quote unquote, right? Technically.
She got Aaron Sorkin on her side in real life, you know?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So I think it's the ability to change somebody. Okay, you know what? I have this, just like Sorkin, I have this preconceived notion of who you are, but you're not that. it just, you got to work with me a little bit to get there faster. But, you know, when you peel away the layers, this is who you actually are. And I get it.
Yeah, it was great. One of my other favorite scenes in this movie was the scene, pardon me, is when she first goes to trial to cop the plea.
Arraignment.
And they're going, and he's sitting there, Idris Elba is like going to the guy, switches me. Gets up to, and that happens what? Like 3 or 4 times?
But and it's more than that.
Yeah, it's no, a it great, like 5.
It's a great scene. And it lit, number one, it was
levity.
So it was levity. It was comedic. But at the same time, Chris is learning about the person who he is mulling about taking on, and then eventually says, you know what? I'm going to take you on.
Yeah.
And I like then how you heard that part of it is he's mulling about what his, now because you find it out later in the reveal that it was his daughter who read the book, he's mulling over what she said and hearing her and how she's poised. I think it was great. I thought that was a great dynamic, and it was a really well done scene. That's classic Sorkin.
Well, for the daughter, Molly was a hero. And, you know, especially now, even this movie's affected by the Me Too movement. And so, you know, in that sense, even back then, women needed heroes. And an unlikely hero, but yeah, a hero to her.
But yeah, it also speaks a lot when, like, when your daughter, realizing your daughter actually has a hero and looks towards Molly and like, as a positive figure, there has to be something about Molly that is, appealing, that that Jaffe could get on board. So, like, I did like that connection. It took him a while to get there,
yeah,
but he did eventually get there.
But let us not forget, too, another big part of this movie was the interview that Molly's dad had, and who's your hero? Oh, I don't have any heroes. And yet we have this little girl who does have a hero, and it happens to be the person who didn't believe in heroes as a child. I find it funny that part of how Idris Elba got his role is that it was Amy Pascal who had recommended him. And Sorkin had loved a 5-episode arc the actor had done on The Office.
It's a good one.
Places. So I just find that's very interesting. And
yep,
it's good for Idris Elba. You know, it's a good way to get a gunslinger away.
Listen, he's done so many good movies and will continue to do so many.
And he's a good presence on screen.
Let's go back to Kevin Costner, because you brought up that interview, and initially as I'm watching, I'm like, what the hell is this? This is the creepiest thing I've ever seen for a birthday celebration or whatever you want to call it. And B, who is this guy? The dad. And you get that he's stringent and so forth, but why the hell he's doing this is beyond what I comprehended at the moment. And then when it comes back, I was just shocked.
Yeah. I love this because also from the psychological mentality of what his character was. He was a therapist, you know, a psychologist. And he studied, it would make sense that he would study his own kids in that way. Again, another Sorkinism, you can say, of setting up a storyline, and this is your answer. You have the quick interview, but when it comes back, it has a deeper meaning, knowing that when he studied his daughter, she was jaded and bitter and against the world, and there's a reason for that, which also explains why she had such a power struggle with men in her life. It made sense. I think it was great. I didn't see it as creepy at all. I realized there was a bigger point to this.
Yeah, no, I didn't find it as creepy only because, you may find this funny, I listen to Howard Stern. And Howard Stern plays the old tapes of his father interviewing him. Who do you think should be president? Who do you think, what do you think about the war? So I recalled to that for some silly reason because we've heard that play out, and those are real life interviews that Howard's dad would do with himself and his siblings, his sister. So in this movie, I found that to be, I was like, oh, wow, okay. So a father's interviewing the daughter. But I liked how it came full circle, in which the father, Kevin Costner, says, I knew that you knew. And it was from those interviews. And you realize the reason for the treatment that happened. So there was a self-reflection, too, over dad.
Yeah, I think it was also just great character development for Larry Bloom as well, because throughout the entire movie, we're, as an audience, conditioned not to like him because he was so hard on Molly. It's like, we know he's just a dick in real life. But to have that amazing scene on the bench in the park.
It's a great scene.
Where, like, it was an amazing scene explaining everything. But then at the end of it, Molly's the one consoling her father. And the audience is now feeling for the father where we shouldn't because he's been a dick this whole movie. You're like, oh, man, that's just amazing when a character has a full arc in that way and you feel for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great scene. However, I mean, that was my one thing. However, so highly coincidental that, you know, he would be at the park skating rink at exactly the same time in a very crowded New York City. They found one another, but I forgive it.
But, like, and a father would know where their kids are.
Here's the thing, right?
Would figure it out.
At first, I was like, wait, what the hell? But, and I thought maybe it was a mirage that she was thinking and
that's
so
what
forth.
I thought too.
But, you know, he has that line that, yeah, I know what's going on in your life. You're on trial. So, of course, I was going to come. So, in that sense, you know, whether he followed her or whatnot, you know, he's done his due diligence and whatnot, and at that point, I think he would have found her. I don't think it's not a big stretch as I initially was like, wait, what?
Yeah. Right.
But this scene on the bench like erases all that because it was just done so well. Again, kudos to the actors who pull it off. They were able to pull it off, and Kevin Costner's dad, to your point too, he doesn't come off as being. There's a warm side to him, previous than what we've seen from him before. And when he even says, like, I'm going to find this guy, I'm going to have somebody find this guy, and then I'm going to hire somebody else to kill this guy. No, you can't do that. No, he hurt my daughter. And I really love that scene, too, because that is a true protection of a parental love.
Yeah, that's what I love, because throughout the entire film, we see Larry Bloom as the therapist. You never see him as the father. And this moment, you actually saw him being an actual father. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's it where it pulls at your heartstrings. And that's why we ultimately feel for him at the end. I think it was a great character switch, just in, you know, one person alone. But from going from someone who's so psychological, you know, mentality to someone who's actually just feeling as a parent, it was beautifully executed within a few minutes.
And I did like, again...
It was earned.
It was very much earned.
It was
earned.
Very earned.
Absolutely. And I did like, he goes, okay, I'm going to do for you what everybody asks of the therapist and never gets. Answers. I'm going to give you three. And I liked when he gave that first one about, yeah, you wanted to dominate over men. She's like, really? He goes, yeah, really. And then when they get to the last two, he goes, yeah, and she's like, yeah, but what about dominating over men? He goes, that was a red herring. He goes, I threw that in there to grab you and to get you involved in this. And that was very fascinating because it turns that conversation to an extent. Yeah. I think the other two are they're the positive where that one was the negative in a sense. I found, again, the about face is brilliant. It's very brilliantly written and performed.
So let's shift gears a little bit, still tying into Kevin Costner, but a great ally towards to Aaron Sorkin in the making of this movie, because he would give him tips of how to, you know, sometimes how to move the camera if he was involved and so forth. And the way he does it, he tried to do it in secret so that way Aaron looked good, and then Aaron would be like, that was Kevin's idea.
Yeah. Well, also, Kevin, Academy Award winner, he's known for his directing as well, and I think that's just good for an actor to just help a fellow artist, you know? And we've seen it other times when George Clooney helped with some of the writing in Gravity, you know? Like, we've had those moments where other actors just help for the creative process, don't want to take credit because they are humble. They're doing it for the art.
They are doing it for the art. They're doing it for the project. But when we're talking Aaron Sorkin and doing his first film, all right, John Landis had said this. Many people, even Mel Brooks or even Burt Reynolds, you have to surround yourself with people who are probably going to be smarter than you to help you out. So when you put a camera somewhere, somebody's going to come up to you and say, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. No. You got to put it over here because the sun is going to wipe out your shot or something. So when Aaron Sorkin is coming on board as a directing for the first time, he surrounded himself with extremely talented people from both behind and in front of the camera. And when you get somebody like Acosta who has that experience, and it's not like, remember The Accountant? We talk about this. That director was like, okay, Ben Affleck, you don't tell me what to do. It's like, dipshit, you might have, like, not that The Accountant was horrible, but he might have had something to lend to you as a director who's had a claim as a director. Like, there could have been something, a gem.
Those exact words, but yes.
Yeah, but he basically said that to him. So when you have somebody like an Aaron Sorkin or anytime who's directing for the first time, they're supposed to take a little bit of, like, hey, for my cinematographer, how do I make this look? Like, what's the lighting? It's all part of the collaborative effort. And I got to appreciate the people who say, I can be good, but the other people are helping me look good.
And I appreciated that. And even so much so when we talk about the actual poker, they assigned 6 days worth of just poker shooting, which, you know, that's a fairly large amount of time because they want each of those shots to look interesting and, you know, you pointed out earlier, Marissa, to be engaging.
Yeah. I love that during the production because they had so many, they just wanted real authentic shots and inserts and pushing all the cards and the chips and all that. They wanted to actually look like a real poker game. And they actually had their extras play real poker. They did hire a lot of professional poker players to actually authentically look like they're playing poker.
Yeah, and Sorkin did say, I reminded them that when we first got the set, I was going to cut a check for $2,500 to whoever had the most chips when we wrapped. And then I told everyone, guys, just play cards. Don't worry about your line. Don't worry where the camera is. Because they all want to be the best player at whatever table they were sitting at. At the end of the day, he says, those extras are the highest paid people on set. He goes, I think Michael Cera left without his house. So that, to
high
me...
High stakes bidding.
So that, to me, was great. That's like a funny anecdote of... And again, this was within a week or so of filming. I thought it was brilliant. I think it's hysterical.
Yeah, and the fact that he could shoot that fast overall. Because even when we talk about the Idris Elba scenes with Jessica... They were lightning fast, and, you know, as far as, you know, it's concerned with the dialogue, you have to nail it right. And so to be able to do it in that short amount of time with a first-time director is phenomenal. Taking a quick step back, they had a bunch of meetings, and at first they wanted to, of course, Aaron's going to go to David Fincher. Couldn't do it, but then they went through the entire list, and Amy's just like, I think the way he tells it, that was always going to be the end result that they were going to. They were just like, all right, let's just go through this list. And then, what about you? And then he had Christmas to really think it over. And
I like how he comes back and they're like, listen, the shit or get off the pot. What are you going to do? Are you going to direct this movie or not? And he's like, he said it was one of the most nervous parts of his life when he actually shook hands and said, I'm going to do this. And then he's like, how am I going to do this? Right. So it's a really good story for him. And again, he proved to be the good choice. I mean, he's been doing this whether on TV, he's been blessed and graced to work with good directors
and actors
who get his dialogue. And in the movie business, he's had some really good people directing his works.
Right, so. And it's not like he doesn't know the formula for television and movies. He knows the structure. He knows how movies are actually executed. He's been on set.
Sure.
He knows it. And even Jessica Chastain gave him a hard time afterwards. She's like, I'm so mad at you. And he's like, why? He's like, she's like, you could have been making movies this whole time. You know, but like you've always been writing. And Jessica Chastain herself even says there was no reservations of her saying yes to a quote-unquote first-time director because she knows that Aaron Sorkin knows the business, no movie structure, and she's like, yeah, I'm surrounded by an artist. There's no problem. It's Aaron Sorkin, man.
Yeah, and in part, that's how he gets his cast.
There's no problem.
Because his reputation precedes him as a writer.
Right.
So, of course, we're going to give him his due diligence as a And of course, we're going to give him his due diligence as a first-time director. And he was as controlling and directing, apparently, as he is in his writing. So it was really interesting, too, when we talk about Jessica Chastain, because apparently the story that he loved to talk about is there was a scene where Molly's supposed to go, I was a brat. And he would say, cut, cut, cut. He goes, Jessica, he goes, I need five M's. You're only doing me about three. He goes, I need five. And she'd go, really? But then she goes on to say, but her revenge on her was happened a little later, rehearsing a scene. And she says, she said, yeah. And he walks over and goes to her. He goes, that's not the line, Jessica. She goes, I've never written the word yeah in any one of my scripts. And she got the script supervisor over. She goes, really? Look. And there it was, yeah. And so he's like, just had to laugh it off.
He's like, yeah.
He's like, yeah.
Yeah.
But you will be wrong.
It's like, nah, he's so, right. He does.
At least he had a sense of humor about himself, too, in doing this. And I think the people really wanted to perform for him. You know, they wanted to give him his best shot.
Right. And Sorkin does say himself that every word is very meticulous, is very direct. And he says there's not... if there is a noise or just whatever mannerism, like, yeah, whatever, it's not written. And he says if it's not on the script, then it shouldn't be in the movie.
Well, for clarity, I like that approach for non-comedies. For comedies,
yes. All bets are off. I agree.
Yeah, you gotta play a little bit loose.
I agree. But I also do love the importance of the word.
Yes.
And how important it is, the spoken word. Dialogue. We talk about this. So many people can get it wrong, but I love that there's something hinged upon the spoken word or the acted word. So,
well, when you talk about, you know, we're talking about his directing, but as a writer, you know, what you have to appreciate is he's gone through the thought process of why this person would say this. And so it's the, listen, you're not really thinking about it. I've had plenty of time to think. So just do it this way. It's a very Alfred Hitchcock type of mentality.
And Sorkin does have a rhythm in his writing. And you can see in every television show, every movie that we talked about. We talked about Steve Jobs and how fast of a pace a movie that was, even though it was set in three structures. Newsroom. I love that show. It's so good. Every dialogue, it's so fast-paced. It's like you have to drink a pot of coffee before to keep up with Sorkin. Like, he's known for that. That is his fast-paced dialogue. If you can't keep up with it, then you're going
to
get lost.
And you have to say it, too, because it also you brought up Hitchcock. It also reminds me of a story when Harrison Ford has told this story many a times when filming the very first Star Wars movie. And, you know, they'd be sitting around and Harrison Ford would be reading the script and he'd be like, George, you can't say this shit. He goes, really? He goes, and George is like, Harrison, I want you to do it as said in the script. Trust me, it'll come off. And they did it, and then look what happened. So in people, in Sorkin in particular, if he's putting his words together, he wants them done in a particular way. Again, it just goes back. I hate to be a broken record, but you've got to find the right people to do it, too. Even his television shows were perfectly cast. They've won so many Emmys, too.
So good.
For doing exactly what was written on page, but you need talent to do it. There's a timing involved, a cadence even.
Yeah, there's a rhythm.
For it to work.
There's definitely a rhythm. Well, and even with the voiceovers, those are really fast. And I'm glad you can assume that they didn't actually have to memorize those because you could just be in an ADR booth reading a whole 10-page of dialogue and be fine, call a voiceover. But that had a fast-paced rhythm, too. Not once did it actually... I mean, I think the only moment where the movie slowed down was when she got beat up and she's, like, healing in her own apartment suite. That's the only moment there's really no dialogue. But everything else is, like, go. Mm-hmm. Zero to 1,000, go.
So there's a term I have, and I'm sure a lot of productions use it, block, light, shoot, right? And when you talk about that and with where we're going with it, block, light, shoot means you first block it, then the actors go and get fully prepped while the lighting's happening, and then you shoot it. So as part of the block, light, shoot on this movie, the crew was just watching a play, and they would just get standing ovations for just the rehearsals. Because it's a mini play of sorts.
Right.
And you know, you go through it for 10-minute scenes, and it's like, oh, that's wonderful.
Right.
All right, now let's actually do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's brilliant, and it's such a great muscle as an actor to have, too, because if you remember, it's like theater and Broadway, the actual ones that are acting out. People are acting out 120-page to 160-page dialogue every single night without going back to their script. They have to memorize 160-plus pages, mm-hmm. where this is like they had to do increments of 10. Yeah, there's a lot in 10, but it's not 160 pages compared to 100,
right.
compared to 10. So right. it's actually easy to shoot. It's easy to remember. Gilmore Girls, that's an example of very, very fast-paced dialogue, which I love. I love that show, too. The actors themselves also had to study in a rhythmic pace of 10 pages of dialogue every single day because that's how much dialogue there was.
Right.
It's a known thing.
It's very Shakespearean, isn't it?
Yeah.
Also, soap operas, you know, they have to shoot 70 pages of dialogue a day. It's a sure. structure. It's a muscle memory.
Yeah, but my joke with soap operas is like, Dimitri, your uncle, who's also your mom, that the doctor slept with. And then you're like, huh? And then it's just like,
and I just
is your father.
You, and I just look at you and go, I'm not Dimitri. Go away. No, but
it's the exercise of memorizing so much in a small amount of time.
And granted, too, it's the crew that you have and how they're being filmed and lit and bringing whatever realism there is to it. So, he put together a great team. And he even says nothing that the team that his collaborators, he says nothing less than co-authors of the film. Mm-hmm. So, you know. Whether he decides to continue to direct or not, you know, that's fine. His debut, again, how many times have we watched a movie where it's a first-time director and you sort of get the sense that it's a first-time director? Only because they try to be maybe a little flashy and whatnot. I'm not necessarily saying they're making some bad movies, although there have been. But his movie actually looked... There were times where I was like going... Oh, this looks very David Fincher. Did he direct this? He took cues from...
Well, he also had a direct line to David and was like, hey, what do I do?
What do I do?
So that certainly helps. Yeah. And David being gracious enough to actually lend a device, which sure. of course he would. Why wouldn't he?
Why wouldn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. So. I mean, David Fincher and Aaron Sorkin, hello, Social Network. Fantastic movie.
Sure.
Also Academy Award winning. So you know Aaron Sorkin has all the tools and the chops to direct as
right.
well.
Yeah.
He's great.
So, and we had a female, again, we had a female cinematographer, Charlotte Bruce Christensen.
Great job.
Who worked on this, and she had worked on Fences, Girl in a Train. She did Beautiful such a film. Great, great job of doing this and filming, whether it was the poker scenes, but filming the, you know, filming the Hollywood high end of it all, the way that this was look. And you know, it was shot digitally, but Christensen worked with Panavision, catch this, to find some 1960s anamorphic lenses that provided the necessary depth of field and softness of the background when using a studio's space. A lot of this was filmed in a studio, so the movie set against the backdrop of the glamour, the size, and the loneliness of the Colorado mountains, Hollywood, and New York City, and you got all of that.
Yeah.
And the movie did look the movie looked great.
It looked cool the times it needed to. It looked yes. inviting in the times of especially the poker stuff. You kind of got sucked into it, like, oh, they're having fun. I want fun.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And you definitely got the different worlds from compared to LA to New York. LA was warmer. Sunny orange browns, you know, it had a warmer feel to it, you know, as LA is. It's sunny out here. And compared to New York, it was like all white, all beige, all color, cold. It was cold. And it definitely helped with the personality shift.
Yeah, and I loved how we go from that, what was it, the Crocodile Lounge or whatever that bar was,
the dive bar,
to the Four Seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And look how much that game was upped. Look how much the event was upped and what she was able to do with it.
Yeah, just the high stakes alone. She went from, like, what was it, a $5,000 buy-in?
Right.
Compared to New York, which was, she upped it to, what was it, $100,000 buy-in?
Right.
It's like even 250. Like she more than doubled her. Like I can't do the math there, but like she really increased it. Even I think one of the funnier moments was the Monet painting as the buy-in. No, you take
that back. That's actual Monet. And again, though, each casino that we saw, from whether it be the Four Seasons, whether it be the Plaza, or whether it be the Commerce Casino, where we see Eustace, that each one had its own different feel. Being, you know, the Commerce Casino, I've been inside that casino. That's exactly how it looks. The Four Seasons look like it could have come out of the Bellagio, except it was even more inviting than that. So, and then when she was at Trump, it did seem a little bit more, I want to say, Spartan. It wasn't as glamorous, but it was very power brokerish in there. And she had different clientele as well. I wanted to talk about quickly, because I thought that he was great, Joe Keery, the kid from Stranger Things. Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, there's all this talk about Millie Bobby Brown. And I'm like, why are you like not focusing on some of these other kids who are equally as good? And this Joe Keery in Stranger Things, I thought somebody should snap him up and start using him in movies. And when I saw him in this movie, because of his hair, like you just, if you watch Stranger Things, you knew who he was. You go, oh that's the Stranger.
Yeah, I was like, oh.
Oh, hey. And I was like, oh, my God, good for you. Aaron Sorkin put you, good for you. Because you deserve, and in the small role that he has, like that scene was, that scene was great. Like when he was trying to pawn off the false chips, the fake chips. That kid was good.
Also, this was a great moment when like she's showing all the security cameras, like, don't mess with me. I know how to play this game. You don't. And I think that was brilliant. I was like, yeah, this was probably one of the first power moves that she actually explained to the audience. It's like, no, I know what I'm doing. Don't mess with my game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you go, girl.
But it was false.
It was false.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about music, shall we? Daniel Pemberton just also did recent, speaking of Steve Jobs, he did Steve Jobs. He's done a lot of things recently too. All the Money in the World, which we just talked about last week. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And then maybe not so good one, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. But
I like that one. That was a fun one. I think he did a great job. We always talk about the moments where we remember it the most. I think there was an amazing... Two of my favorite moments were when she just got beat up in her own apartment suite, and she's healing, and the editing goes like flash in, flash out, like right. Go in. It's all music. It's all blue mixed with the music. It was gorgeous, and you felt for her. You felt so bad for her. Beautifully done.
Yeah, I felt that the music never it never overplayed its hand, so to speak. It was just the right tone. We're playing these poker games. It could have been way over the top, right? Like to make this almost a circus kind of a, you know, yeah, I'm all in, and make it very fast paced editing and have the movie, the music to match it. But it never reached that height. And I thought that was very smart and well played. So. I think, totally. If the music overtook the scenes would have just felt something like a sports game, like a sports movie. Which this wasn't a sports movie, you know. This is a really solid story.
And Pemberton himself, who said about the score, he said, I wanted to write a bit more like the band writing the score rather than a sort of film composer. I approached it with more a rhythmic rock way than a melodic traditional film composing way. So he says that was really fun. You felt some like rock. And there were some actual diegetic songs in the movie that spoke to the early 2000s and just the time that they were living in.
Absolutely. So. As far as promotion, it did around... In September, it did the Toronto Film Festival. Molly actually is banned in Canada, so she was given special 24 hours to be able to attend that premiere. And All the Money in the World was actually supposed to be at the AFI Festival because of the things we talked about in that movie. Right. Check that out. I won't get into it. It replaced this, so it had, you know, had a circuit of two film festivals, which is great.
That's interesting how Molly is banned in Canada, one of the nicest countries in the world. Like, what did she do to piss off the Canadians?
It's well, just, all of this.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
This is the story.
It's just funny. It's actually comedic to think about it.
Yeah.
Overall, so we're towards the end of January, and it's been out, what, a month and a half?
Well, yeah, I mean, its initial release was Christmas Day for Limited. And again, it was a very interesting, I think, from marketing to the way they rolled this out, it was very interesting. You know, it was almost as if STX was trying to figure out how to release this movie and how to market it. They knew that there was something there. Personally, I saw the trailer, and I was like, yeah, I'm in on this story. This looks like it'll be a really well-played story, and I'm already in on the character seems engaging. So, I mean, all in, that's the thing. It's done $25 million, and I feel it should be – I feel it deserves better than that. Considering a movie that they platformed out, it got some decent recognition, and then it went wide. But even when it went wide – you know, we're looking at it came in at number 7. Well, I know it's a tough time period.
I think it's a tough time period simply because it was initially being carried by the Weinstein Company, and then that they got the movie back, and so Warner Brothers came in and stepped up, which is great. But you have to readjust.
Molly's Game was released by STX. I think you, Paddington 2 was a Weinstein movie. But Molly's Game was STX Entertainment. They're sort of the newbies. I still call them the newbies. They're a couple of years in. Their first movie, The Gift, which I thought was very well done. I believe we covered that here. And here we go. And with Molly's Game, I believe they looked at it and said, well, we can perhaps get a Jessica Chastain nomination. Idris Elba, maybe Aaron Sorkin for writing. So I think that's why the platform and the rush to get it out on Christmas Day. I just wish more people would go out and see this movie. I think it's relevant. I think it's a entertaining story. Right. It's very well done. It's a good adult rated R movie that has an extremely strong character. Female character. What I loved about this female character and the way that Jessica Chastain portrayed her is she was vulnerable. There was a vulnerableness to her. Mm-hmm. And you saw that. And that, to me, makes any character, whether you're captain of a spaceship or not, if you don't have vulnerability, we can't all just be superheroes and have our suits be taken away from us. There was a vulnerability to her that made her more real.
A vulnerability and a likeness to her.
Correct.
Like, she had to be likable for us to follow her throughout this entire film. And Jessica Chastain is a very well-renowned actress now because of the roles she's been in. She's been nominated for Academy Awards several different times. She's an amazing actress in and of herself. Also, I don't think that helps the movie either, is because this movie wasn't released foreign. It's only domestic. So, yeah, don't base it off in the numbers because it's not making a lot. But just base it off of the talent and writing alone.
I think everyone just dumps everything on December 25th and limited release. And then I think even I'm playing catch up. And so that hopefully that plays into it. To what degree, percentage, I don't know. But, you know, there's plenty of Oscar nominated movies that I've yet to see that I'm putting in the calendar. And Anatomy is too, by the way.
But you absolutely. But the other thing too about this movie, when you look at reception on Rotten Tomatoes, I believe at last check it was an 81%.
Yeah.
And again, that's solid. I thought it might have been maybe a little higher. I read some of the reviews, the negative ones, and it's like, what the hell movie did you see? Like, this is just bashing. Like, you're making no sense. Because I really think that this is. And there were parts of this movie, too, that made me think of American Made with Tom Cruise. Great. Another really good movie, based on a true story that told me a story that I really wasn't familiar with. But the way that it was directed and performed, this movie had those elements in it because we had a little bit of humor, some of that bizarre, like that craziness going on. I think Molly's Game is far better than $25 million in box office would lend. I think it's a better movie.
Yeah.
Well, we'll find out. I mean, Cinema Score, it's getting an A minus, so that's high, you know. Mm-hmm. Certainly, it may not be an A, but that's certainly, you know, a B. The difference between an A minus and a B plus can be quite vast. So, right. So hopefully people continue to go see it. Any final thoughts before we wrap up this anatomy? Marissa?
I really enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of Jessica and Aaron. Put them together in a room and you create magic that is Molly's Game. I would probably watch this again because there was so much that happened. You're bound to miss something. But I think it's just a well-paced, well-acted, well-written film that more people should see.
Yeah, agreed. And again, it was about stuff that I didn't know. And, you know, I'd seen Winter Olympics before. I don't recall that family, the Brown family, you know.
Right. I love
that. That was just very fascinating to me that she had potential to be a great Olympic United States star. No. And this was the path. Like, you go, how does that happen? How do you do this? And this movie succinctly puts it in such a believable fashion, I'm sure like her book, that you just buy into it and you say, oh, okay. And how it's rags to riches in a sense. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, how do I go from losing that? Now I'm going to become this and become an entrepreneur.
Well,
so
that's the beauty of it all. And fail until you succeed and keep on failing. Just have the same enthusiasm. Thank you guys as always for watching along or listening. Your comments are important to us simply because when we talk about this movie, it's not the end of everything. You know, we talk. There's plenty more that we could talk about and that we want to talk about, but we want to talk about it with you. So go ahead, send us your comments, your thoughts on the movie. We appreciate it. And speaking to the larger context of things here at Anatomy, we're going to get through all the Oscar nominated movies.
Yes.
We've already done some, so check those out. We will be doing more. In fact, next week, we've decided we're going to do The Darkest Hour and I, Tonya. So you can look forward to those next week. And speaking of Steve Jobs and other Aaron Sorkin movies or even David Fincher movies, we've done, as long as we've been around, we've done them all. So,
oh, yeah, actually.
So check them out.
Steve Jobs.
They're in our library for you to browse through.
Yeah.
And they're free, just like a library.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're there for posterity's sake.
We'll see you guys out at DMovies 17.
At DMovies 1701. Support me on Twitter. I have, I'm up to 13 followers now. But I think some of them are robots or when I retweet stuff. Then I literally, like a meter, I could see it. I could see my fanship drop. it's like, oh, okay, lost another one.
Well, now I think you tease them so much that they're like, all right, we're just going to purposefully not follow you. Marissa.
At Serafini TV. And also check out our sister network, AfterBuzz TV. We covered the Newsroom after show. It's such a brilliant show. If you guys don't know Aaron Sorkin, watch the Newsroom because that is a relevant show that definitely shows his writing style and just like the relevance of his writing.
And of course, I'm at Phil Svitek. Thank you guys as always. We'll see you guys next time on another Anatomy of a Movie.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.